person.
Claro, tengo un equipo de mierda.
I think it is also some matter of some consensus that one of the essays that he wrote some 20 years ago, it's the most consequential, seminal essay to be written in terms of shaping the discourse of democracy in Iran and in criticizing at the most fundamental philosophical level the very foundations of the regime. His argument on the contingent nature of truth, perhaps a Baste Theorique, what was known as that article, but the fundamental argument in the essay, which has truly become a seminal essay, was that human cognition, human knowledge of religious texts are always contingent, are always human, and thus the claim of infallibility, which is now the foundation of despotism in Iran, is a false, untenable claim, and it's a false, untenable claim both in religious context as well as the democratic context.
Can you please use a microphone?
I am trying to use the microphone. I'm sorry. I think I have to get it closer. Yes, well, I'm going to go sit down. You have to make sure that you have come to hear Sruj, not me. So I'll sit down in a minute. I think what makes Professor Sruj such a formidable foe for his critics and for the regime is his deep immersion in both Islamic tradition as well as the Western traditions of philosophy. He has saddled both of these, he has mastered both of these, and from them he has brought a unique mixture that makes him, according to several journals, one of the 100 most influential thinkers in the world, not just in Iran, in the world in the last decade. Tonight, however, he is not going to talk about his political views, seminal as they were, but we're going to hear about an aspect of his scholarship that those of us who lived in Iran in 1979 knew well. That is his mastery of Rumi, the program that he began teaching on television. It was essentially a class that he taught on television, soon became one of the most popular programs on television in those days, and his ability to conjure thousands of lines of poetry became very famous very quickly. The program became very popular very quickly, and like everything else that becomes popular very quickly, the plug was pulled on it very quickly because the regime did not want Sruj to become even more popular than he was. So you're going to hear about his views on Sruj today in English, the next 3 days in Persian. The programs are back there, so it is with great privilege and pleasure that I welcome Professor Sruj to our campus again.
Good evening, everybody. Okay. Good evening, everybody. Can you hear me? Do you have a problem? Because always I have got a problem with my soft voice, and hope you do not have any problem today, and my message can reach you easily and swiftly. I am very grateful to all of you for being here, for coming, and especially to Professor Milani and Iranian Studies Center, and of course Islamic Studies Center, who are the main inviters of me and the people who facilitated my coming here, and they I extend my special thanks to all of them. Professor Milani actually was very, very generous indeed in introducing me, and I am very thankful to him and the program that he is actually leading here in this university. As he mentioned, this is my second time to deliver a talk here to the Iranian as well as non-Iranian community, and I am very glad that this time I'm going to speak about Rumi, my love, my life love. Professor Milani actually had a different view that perhaps I should say something about my political ideas here, but believe me, Professor Milani, talking about your love is more difficult than talking about politics. Now I actually, perhaps through the suggestion of Professor Bashir, perhaps now I begin my talk about Rumi. This will be, as he mentioned, the first of a four lectures. Three others will be in Persian, and this one, by way of introduction, is in English. All of you, of course, are welcome to the Persian classes as well. And Rumi, of course, you have no shortage of interest in Rumi here in America, nor in books and articles written about him. I remember one of the books written about some 80 years after the death of Rumi mentions the story that once Rumi actually entered the office, if you like, the room of one of his students. He was reading the book of Rumi, Masnavi, and then actually he put it on the ground and used it as a pillow. Rumi actually got angry and said, "My book is not something to become, to be used as a pillow. It will be a world book in future." And now I see that his prediction has come truly true. And he is a world-class, of course, poet, and his book is well-known everywhere. There are so many scholars here in America and in the West who know him, who understand him, who translate him, both in prose and in poem. And Coleman Barks, for example, is an American poet who understands Rumi very well and who popularized Rumi here in America. And I know that through him, a huge number of people of Americans came to know Rumi and to understand him and to enjoy his poetry and so on and so forth. Therefore, when I mentioned the word Rumi, the name Rumi, I'm sure that he is a household name nowadays. And everybody knows him, understands him, and try to know more about him. And this is, of course, we are proud of this, because Rumi originally comes from where now is called Afghanistan and Iran, and I will come to that. Now, the topic of the my talk here is Rumi, the Prophet of Love. There is a missing word here, which you have to wait until I come to that and disclose that missing word, which is most important. Deliberately, I left it out, and then I will fill it in during my speech. But now let us be content with three words which I have put in the title: Rumi, the Prophet of Love. Now, as far as Rumi, the word Rumi is concerned, you are all aware that we Iranians and people who come from the Persian-speaking lands, usually we do not call him Rumi. Of course, there is no harm in calling him as such, but Rumi is a title given to him by Westerners. And we usually call him Balkhi or Mawlana Jalaluddin and so on, because he comes from Balkh, a city in the land which is called Afghanistan nowadays. Of course, Balkh no longer exists, and perhaps Mazar-e-Sharif, which is a well-known city, is in place of Balkh. Anyway, he comes from there, so if you like, you may call him an Afghani, but 700 years ago, when he was born, of course, there was no Afghanistan. And Afghanistan is a neologism, is a new land created, you know, some 100 years ago. So he belongs to the greater Iran, Khorasan, and those parts of Iran to the east of Iran. So, of course, he was a Persian-speaking person, a Muslim. And he never lived in Iran, actually, and until age 12, he lived in Afghanistan, in Balkh, and then he migrated immediately before the invasion of Mongols. And he left Afghanistan, and through Iran, actually, he managed to go to Mecca for pilgrimage and then return to the place where he died, and his tomb is there in Konya, the Turkey nowadays. You know, of course, that the Turkey, again, is a neologism, is a new country. That was not the case 700 years ago. Even it was before the fall of Byzantine Empire. And the city of Konya, and the very title, the very name comes from icons. And it was a very important Christian city full of icons in Orthodox Church. And so they, he and his family tried to settle there. And they settled for the rest of the life of Rumi and, of course, his descendants up to now. Now you have got one of his descendants who is the leader and the mentor of the Mughlavi order in Turkey. Now, the word Rumi means, of course, Roman, somebody who lives or who comes from Rome. And Rome means meant at that time Greece and Byzantine Empire. And because of his living there, so he was called Roman or Rumi, but that is not the word that we use it. And Rumi himself did not use it at all. There are some false, poems attributed to him, which has got the word Rumi in it, but they are absolutely false and fabricated and attributed to him, and it is not right. So he is Balkhi, if you like, and he's an Iranian. I would like to say that perhaps on the basis of the school of Rumi, it is not appropriate to insist on the point that he was perhaps an Iranian, because he belonged nowhere. Actually, he was a meta-historical figure, a meta-geographical figure in reality. And all his, actually, teachings tell us that our vatan, our mainland, is elsewhere. We are just, guests here in this world, and our main place, our main land, and is somewhere else where our souls have come from. But nevertheless, we have to be careful that first and foremost he belongs to Iranian culture, and then of course he belongs to the world culture, and especially nowadays in the age of globalization, you can see that his teachings, his ideas is prevailing everywhere, and people are discovering him anew in order to understand his message. So much for the word Rumi and the person. And as I mentioned, he was born in the 13th century AD. So remember that he lived some 700 years ago, when even before the fall of the Byzantine Empire, when the Islamic civilization was in its full flower, and he represented that civilization at that time in a most mastery way. Now, coming to the word prophet, that's the second word I used in the topic, but now it's time to fulfill my promise and to disclose the word which is missing in the title, and that is the word poet. I should have said the poet prophet of love, because Rumi was actually a poet. In Persian, we have got two different words, sha'ir on the one hand, which means poet, and nazim on the other hand, which means somebody who is much concerned with meter and rhyme and rhythm and so on, a word organizer, if you like. Now, most of the people who are called poets, they are not poets in reality. They are, as I said, nazims, people who know how to do and how to organize the words and how to measure the rhythm and meter and so on and so forth. Rumi was a poet, but he was not a nazim in that sense. And this distinction is a very important distinction to be borne in mind, because sometimes he himself dismisses, poetry, but when he dismisses poetry, he doesn't mean poeticity in the essence of the word of poet, but actually this the other meaning of the word nazim, which of course did not fit him, and he should not be called as such. So he was a poet. Of course, to be sure, he has got two magnum opus. One is called Masnavi, which is a didactic one, which contains his main teachings on spirituality, on religion, on morality, and so on. And then he has got a Divan, which is real poetry. There you find Rumi the poet. But in Masnavi, you will find Rumi the teacher. There, actually, he is teaching. It was actually written, but not written in the real sense of the word. It was created, it was produced in a class like this. Every night, every evening, actually, Rumi would sit, and some of the students of him, who were laymen, just laymen, surrounded him, and he produced, verses to them. And they wrote it down, took it down. And that was how Masnavi was created, some 25,000 lines. And during roughly 15 years that he produced, from the age 55 roughly until the age of 68. So that came as a book, which we now call it Masnavi. And as I said, it contains more than 25,000 verses. He never edited the book. He never went back to the book in order to rewrite it, redo it, re-edit it, and so on and so forth. And he just produced it like this, like a fountain. He poured out what was in his mind, what was in his heart. And it was not in no conventional way to do it. He never thought about what he was saying. He was just like sun. The symbolism that he liked so much, like sun shining, without perhaps deliberation, just like that. He rose and there were, people there, and he was shining upon them, and they took note of what he said. Sometimes during a story, actually, he says that he can no longer continue the storytelling, and so he just stops there, and everybody goes home. And then the day after, people come to him, and he, continues the story of the yesterday. Sometimes when he's talking or producing poetry to his student, somebody walks in. And all these, are there in the book and in his poetry. Sometimes he's not, very, he's very upset because of the person who comes in. Sometimes he likes the person who comes in. And all this actually he indicates in his poetry. So when you read the book, you find it a very lively one. It is not conventional. It is, just like a proceeding of the meetings that he had with his students. It's more or less like the Quran, and sometimes he likes this similitude to be made. It's like the Quran, because the Quran was not, there like a book, sent down to the Prophet. It was produced during the life of the Prophet. And, verse by verse was actually relevant to the event that the Prophet and the whole Muslim Ummah was going through. Therefore, it was not a pre-planned book to be there with God and then wholly sent down to the Prophet. It was produced gradually, step by step. Exactly that was the case with Rumi's Masnavi, that he didn't have any pre-plan for producing those poetry. He just came to the class fresh, full of ideas, but no idea what to say and how to continue. And only circumstances actually told him how to go on, how to continue, what to say, what not to say, and the events that happened during the meeting and the gathering. It's quite lively, and it tells you all about the psychology of Rumi himself and the whereabouts that he used to live, and, of course, the rich, immensely rich mind of Rumi and his experience that he tried to share with others. Now, this is as much as Masnavi is concerned, but when you come to the Diwan, there actually he's a real, real poet. There actually he doesn't, for him nothing is for granted, neither religion, nor God, nor spirituality, nor human life, nothing. He is a free man in the extreme sense of the word, and just what comes to him as a vivid and lucid experience, he just wants to share with others. Here, actually, he finds the language of poetry the most relevant language. He cannot say the same thing, you know, because poetry is to say things that you cannot say it otherwise. I mean, poetry is not to say things that you can say it in other languages, in other styles. No, it is not poetry. It is just art. But you as a poet, you try to say in the language of poetry things that you cannot say it otherwise. Rumi, if he were not a poet, he would not become eternal. He would not become a poet for all times. Because of his poeticity, because of his poetness, because of the essence of poeticity in his writing and his speech, that now he's still with us. And we can enjoy sitting with him and reading him and, you know, understanding him and getting his message out of the book. So in Divan, actually, is a real poet. And he tries, you know, to show us a different horizon, a different, you know, face of the whole world, of the whole reality of being. And through him there, actually, you will find a different person altogether who perhaps comes from a different corner of the world and who wants to tell you something and to show you something that you have never seen before and you have never known before. And through that, you will come to understand the real spirituality and Islamic spirituality, of course, as far as he knew it. Now, he was also a prophet of love. So two more words here, two more concepts here need some explanation. He was a prophet. First of all, let me remind you that in history, I do not remember, and if you now please do remind me, I don't think that any prophet so far has ever been a poet. Indeed, in Islam and in the Quran, there is clear verses that says that poets cannot become prophets. And it is no good for the prophet to be a poet. So it is rejected out of hand because poeticity or poetness is considered as something, as someone who deals with imagination. Whereas for a prophet, imagination is no good. You know, you have to have a direct access to reality. If the imagination comes, you know, in the way, so you will not have the direct access to reality and the revelation will become false or contaminated, perhaps, by the products of the imagination and the prophethood will be spoiled altogether. So for the prophets, being a poet is not a perfection. Rather, it is something which is tantamount to denigration. Now, why I call Rumi a prophet then? This is a paradoxical term, a poet-prophet. He was a poet at the same time he was a prophet. But he was a prophet of love. And this bit is something which explains the word prophet and the title poet-prophet for Rumi. Let me remind you that the prophet of love is an expression which is used by Rumi himself. Of course, I mean, we do not know really why he uses the expression and who is the addressee of this expression. I mean, most likely he means himself. You know, Peygamber Ishq Asuz Mihrab, he is the prophet of love coming from mosque. So this is exactly the word and the expression that he uses. And therefore, according to him, at least the concept is a valid concept. You can be a prophet of love. You can be a poet and a prophet of love. And as I said, most likely he uses and he means himself when he uses this. Now, even if he did not mean that, I think that nowadays we can use the same expression for him and we can find the concept quite fit of him. He deserves such a title, the prophet of love. Prophet means somebody who perhaps receives some revelations, come to you with new ideas, opens to you new horizons, has got some access to the transcendental, and addresses your deepest layer of soul, of spirit, and so on and so forth. Somebody whose message becomes somehow eternal. Everybody, when understand him, when come to him, find something new in him. Find something which, you know, can free him. According to Rumi himself, the essence of prophethood is to offer you some sort of freedom. A prophet is there in order to free you from some bondage. The bondage, perhaps, of your animal soul. The bondage of, perhaps, lust and for money and for other things. So the message of freedom, you will find it in Rumi very vividly, very clearly, and many other things which, of course, is there, and you can find there in his writings, in his poetry. So he was a prophet in the sense that he discovered something new. Some new facts were disclosed to him, and he was the recipient of those new facts, of those new ideas. And exactly that idea was the idea of love, and that is why he himself calls himself a prophet of love, or perhaps we prefer to call him a prophet of love. Love is something that he discovered and he propagated, he preached, and through him actually we came to understand love much better, and perhaps to understand that to be a true religious person, to be a true Muslim, is to be a true lover. Therefore, love and religiosity come together, is combined in the message of Rumi. And he teaches us that without being a lover, you cannot know God. You cannot even know yourself. Because in order to know yourself, you have to be either to be loved or to love someone else. Of course, the love that he mentions is divine love. It's not a romantic love, although he does not reject romantic love. But nevertheless, never let us not mistake that the love in his jargon and his language is the divine love most of the time. In order to understand this point better, let me make a comparison between what Rumi says and perhaps what the Prophet of Islam says. You know, because Rumi was no doubt a sincere follower of the Prophet of Islam, a man who respected the Quran very much, and there was no doubt about his sincerity in his religious beliefs. But nevertheless, a comparison between his book, Masnavi or Divan, and the book of Muhammad, of the Prophet of Islam, the Quran, is in order to understand the perhaps the differences between the two. Remind you that Rumi himself was glad that his book be called Persian Quran. So some people actually mentioned in his presence that your book is being called by some people as the Persian Quran. And he said, yes, why not? So that was something which endorsed by him. This is narrated by his son, actually. And so he was quite, you know, enthusiastic. And to him, what he did was perhaps a continuation of the work of the Prophet of Islam, or something more or less on the same footing, on the same level, you know, with the Quran. And he thought that perhaps in the Persian language he has produced something which is comparable with the Quran in the Arabic language. He doesn't say this explicitly, but if you read between the lines, you will find something of the same essence, of the same, you know, meaning in his writing. And when some people actually attacked him, and this is in the third book of Masnavi, attacked him, that what you say is just simple stories, and you have not, you know, come up with very important, you know, philosophical argument in his book. You know what was his answer to them? And this is in Masnavi. He said, exactly the same attacks has been made to the Quran, but Quran is still alive. And my book will be alive, you know, for the rest of the time. And I do not fear. So, you know, the comparison was there in his mind. And he actually warned the people who attacked him, who invaded him, who criticized him, that you are criticizing a book which is there in order to stay for good. It, your criticism will not harm my book and will not distract others from reading the book and from enjoying it. So he was quite clear about his message and about the future of what he did and about the message that he already put in the book. So the comparison was there. But then I would like to tell you that when you compare the book, these two books, if one can ever compare them, one big difference you will find between the two, which makes, I mean, the both of books, you know, more, you know, the message of the both become more clear to you. I said that Rumi was a prophet of love, according to him. But what about the prophet of Islam? Rumi, again, of course, without being very frank and very explicit, tries to tell us that the Quran or the Prophet Muhammad was the prophet of fear and prophet of awe. In his message, fear and awe has got the upper hand. You know, when you read the Quran, everywhere you will see that somebody, i.e. God or the Prophet himself or the history or whatever, warns you against something tragic that might happen to you. And you have to, you know, be careful. Not that, you know, tragic event happened to you. So this is what you find it in the Quran. And, of course, there are very clear verses that this Quran is for the people who are imbued with the fear of God, who are the people of taqwa. You know, taqwa or God-fearing is perhaps the key word in the Quran, the key word in the Quran. If you want to have a description of the Quran, you would say that it is a book of taqwa, a book which teaches you taqwa, God-fearing. God appears to you as a tremendous, you know, as a tremendous entity which imbues you with awe. And because of that, first of all, you worship him, you fear him, and you ask him to for salvation. So so-called salvific religions always, you know, revolve around the idea of fear and awe, and God is the tremendum, mysterium tremendum, according to Rudolf Otto in his book. So this is the God of Quran. And I am not saying that the word love or the word friendship, hope, you cannot find it in the Quran, but that's not the key concept. It is not the key concept. The key concept is taqwa, is fear of God, is khashyat, and the words which are of the same family, more or less. So this is, but the key word in Rumi's, you know, divan is love. You know, and that's why I call him, and everybody is, you know, can accept that he should be and he could be called the prophet of love, because the key word in his teaching, in his experience, is love. This was a second phase, actually, in Iranian Islamic mysticism. Up to the 5th century after the demise of the prophet, the Sufism, the Islamic Sufism, was based roughly on the idea of fearing God. You know, Al-Ghazali, for example, was the most prominent, you know, figure in that school. The person who preached fearing God, and he himself was so fearful of God to the point of paralysis. You know, I have read perhaps all his books, and when you read his books, and you close the book, and you stand, really and truly, you find yourself so despicable and to the point of, you know, nothingness. He tells you that you are nothing in front of us. It's such a great, you know, God. And who are you to claim existence for you? Who are you to think that you can will something? You can determine something. You can even claim to worship him. Everything comes from him. and you are a mere recipient. And you have to be thankful for whatever he gives you, or perhaps he denies you. So this is the relationship between the worshipper and the worshipped. You know, that is the main idea and the key concept in the fear mysticism, in the first phase of Islamic mysticism. But when it comes to Rumi, you know, and some of his predecessors in 6th and in 7th century, you will see that a new phase of mysticism is emerging. Very important, which is still with us. And if it were not for Rumi and his love mysticism, the whole Sufism mysticism would have been incomplete, absolutely. And sometimes even, I would say, misleading. So through Rumi, we find and we come to find another phase of God and another phase of Islamic mysticism, a complementary, perhaps, to the message of the Quran, something that now we have it in toto, in our hands. And that is the love mysticism, which when you combine it with the fear mysticism, you will have like two wings in order to fly in the air of spirituality and transcendentality. But before that, perhaps we did not have it. We lacked it. And that was a very unfortunate thing. So Rumi is a poet, prophet of love, a person who really received perhaps a revelation, somebody who uncovered the idea of love, and who told us that our relationship with God is a relationship of a lover and a beloved, rather than a relationship between a worshipper and a worshipped, you know, a fearful person and a feared one. So those were there before Rumi, but after Rumi we came to discover a new relationship between us and our Creator. Now the union, there will be no union between the fearful and the feared, but there can be a union between the lover and the beloved. Therefore, the idea of union is all over the place in Rumi. In one of his poems, he says that my main commodity to sell you is the commodity of unity and union with God. That is the main commodity. The rest are the rest. And they are there by accident. But what is present in my divan by essence is the idea of unity and the union with God through the divine love. So that is really the main teaching. But in order to understand it fully, you have to go through what he says to become intimate to his language, to go through the stories, that roughly 250 stories, long and short, you can find in his Masnavi. And through these 250 stories, he tries to bring home the idea of love. You know, for example, one of the stories, which is very telling, he says that a lover came to the house of his beloved and knocked at the door. And the beloved from inside said, "Who is there?" He said, "I." He said, "No, no, no, go, go, go. There is no place for you." And he went and, you know, he suffered and a lot and so on and so forth and prepared himself. And then he went back and again knocked at the door. And the beloved asked, "Who is there? Who is it?" He said, "It is you at the door." And he said, "Now it's time for you to come in. Because now there is no separation between us. You learned that there is a unity between us. The one who is behind the door, outside the house, and the one who is inside the house, both of us are one and the same." So this is the lesson that you have to learn through divine love. And when you discover that God is already with you, in you, everywhere, as a lover, as a beloved, then the whole life will become different. Your understanding and your interpretation of religion will become absolutely different than everything. And this is the fragrance that you can, you know, find and experience through the Rumi's book. He was a poet in the sense that whatever he saw and whatever he discovered, he put it into poetry in a most sincere way. without observing, you know, the rules and regulations of, you know, writing poems. And because of that, his poetry is so frank and so intimate and so sincere. I remember that sometimes when I, you know, would, you know, read his divan, it was really difficult for me to leave it and to, you know, go to other things to do. You know, for hours I had to sit and to read as if I was hunted by him. And this is exactly the word he uses. He says, you are not to hunt your beloved. The beloved should come and to hunt you as a lover. And in order to make you his lover, his reader, somebody who is perplexed at the sight of his beloved. So that is, but then when I read, you know, some sonnets and poets of him, and I tried, you know, to finish the job and go to another thing, I felt like somebody who has, who had, you know, a very fatty food, you know. I was somehow, you know, I did not have my senses anymore, and I had to wait for a few minutes, a few hours, in order to come back to my senses. I was so overwhelmed by him. And I am sure that everybody who reads him, he who, you know, jumps into the ocean of Rumi will have the same feeling. And it is not something that you have your will and determination when you go to him. No, it's not. The will and the determination will be his, you know. When you reach him, when you sit with him, when you listen to him, he grasps you and captures you wholly and fully. And in the sense that you cannot, you know, have your own determination anymore. So that is the meaning of being a prophet. A prophet, first and foremost, this is actually the definition that Rumi gives us of the prophethood. He says a prophet is somebody who makes a resurrection in your soul. When he comes to you, you are resurrected anew. This word of resurrection, you know, that he uses, he says when you go to the men of God, to the holy men, to prophets, to spiritual, you feel that you are a different person. You are resurrected anew. You are born anew. And this is exactly what he does with one who goes to him sincerely in order to read him. That's why Rumi tells us that the men of God, whether alive or dead, they are the same. Their influence is the same. Rumi supposedly and apparently is dead, you know, 700 years before. But he's alive. He's truly alive through his words, through his book. And when you read his book, never, never think that you are, you know, dealing with a dead man. You are, you know, receiving words from far behind you. No, 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 it's not the same. He is alive, directly tells you and gives you the revelation and imbues you with the idea of love. And this is what we, you know, dearly needed in our life nowadays. And somebody who tells us what he says when, you know, it comes fresh out of his blood. Just to finish my, and I think my time is now getting over. I remember that once I read in Thomas Eliot, who said that poetry is turning blood into ink. That came as a revelation to me, turning blood into ink. And I remembered that exactly the same you find it in Rumi. خون چو می جوشد منش از شعر رنگی می دهم. My blood is boiling and then it turns into poetry. So that is, you know, the secret and the wisdom behind of the eternality of Rumi's message, of the prophet of love, of the man who emerged as the sun in the east, and now he is shining in the west as well. Thank you very much.
Patricia has agreed to answer some of your questions, so feel free to ask questions. He's going to call on you himself, and
there's a couple minutes.
We just need a couple of minutes to set up the
sure.
technical aspect.
Talk. You mentioned that there's no prophet that you know besides Rumi and Muhammad that were also poets. Do you think Zoroaster was a poet or not, or rather a prophet or not?
Who?
Because Zoroaster, Zarathustra. Mm-hmm. Some 3,200 years ago, Gatha was written only by Paul. Do you know him as a prophet or as just a poet? Thank you.
Well, I mean, poetry, to be sure, you can find it even in the Quran, you know, because the Quran is a very eloquent book. And if you look at it, you know, sometimes even some people have compared it with a book of poetry. But as far as I know, poets, prophets, abhorred poetry in the sense that they thought that perhaps poetry is lower than prophethood. And it's no good for a prophet to be a poet. You know, for example, from the Platonic tradition, he did not like art, he did not like poetry. Actually, he recommended that the poets should be, you know, driven out from the city, because he thought that perhaps philosophy is much higher than poetry. For Aristotle, poetry was perhaps the lowest discipline. Of course, according to him, even the history was even lower than poetry. So this was, you know, how they saw poetry. Now, a prophet calling him a poet, I don't think that was a good propaganda for them. They didn't like it. There is a very, clear verse in the Quran that says, God says, we did not teach poetry to him, to Muhammad. And it does not fit him, you know. As far as Zarathustra is concerned, yes, of course, Gatha, and there are some, poetical stuff in his book. I haven't seen anybody calling him a poet. And because being a poet, even as you see, for example, Rumi himself, in some of his, speeches, he says that to us, it was not a good thing, it was not a good job to be a poet. But since I am among you and you receive poetry much better than the people of the Khurasan, for example, so I begin, to talk to you in poetical style.
The stuff that you mentioned, it's in God's Law. Have you read it?
Yeah. Okay. Yes.
What do you think about it?
As I said, it is a literary piece. It is a piece of literature, that's true. And the same you might have it. For example, in the Bible, you have got the Sonnets of Suleiman. So nobody says that Solomon was a poet. Nobody says that the Bible is a poetical work. But nevertheless, you can, find bits and pieces of this in these books.
So then the definition of poetry is different. Thank you.
Go ahead.
Me?
Yes.
Me?
Yes.
Me?
Yes.
Me?
Yes.
Yes, you.
Professor Suresh, you mentioned the fact that he's a prophet of law. And also you stated that he regards God and you as the same, like that example you mentioned, knocks at the door, says, or it's on you. Putting this together, and putting also his intellect, which was a highly intellectual person, no question. If he was a mathematician, probably would be somebody like Einstein in the 12th century. Knowing all these facts, maybe he didn't believe in the conventional God, all-powerful God, the fearful God, the one that religion was advocating. Is that true? That's a take on it.
That's true. This is absolutely true. That is absolutely true. He was a Muslim and he did believe in God, but his God was different from the conventional God, as you say, the God of the layman. Actually, this is one of his teachings, that everybody has got his own God. There is no one God. There exists one God, of course, but everybody has got his own knowledge, his own picture, his own conception of God. So his conception of God was very different from others. His conception, actually, not only he calls God a beloved, but he calls him love itself. And he says love is God, and God is love. So for him, as I said, this was a new discovery, actually, which he shared with us. So yes, of course, he did worship God, he did believe in the prophethood, but as I have mentioned in one of my articles, at least there are three levels of religiosity. The highest level is the experiential religiosity, and then you have got the discursive religiosity, and then you have got the experiential religiosity. For him, the experiential religiosity was the one that he had and he enjoyed. And God in that level of religiosity is quite different from the God. For example, he tells us that at that level you never ask God, you never pray to God to give you something, to offer you something, to heal you perhaps, to give you some wealth, to nothing. There will be no entreating God, to do something for you. No, there is. He said that I know some men of God who are absolutely silent in front of God. He even do not pray to him. They even do not ask him for anything. They are so one and the same with God that they do not do anything in front of him. In another place, he said that some people do complain from God. There are some other people who thank God. But he say, I know people who never complain, neither complain nor thank God for what he does, for the bounty that he gives them. Because when you thank somebody, it means that you are two. You here and he is there, and then you are grateful to him. When you complain somebody, it means that still there is a separation between you as a complainer and him as somebody who is being complained to. But when there is a union between you two, there will no longer be neither a complaint, a place for complaining, nor a place for thanking. So again, the relationship between you and your God will become totally different. But again, according to Rumi, the religion as it is preached by the Prophet is the religion for the layman. The religion for the elite, like Rumi, is absolutely different. But he is not going to elaborate on that. So it just gives us a hint.
Thanks all for the very informative talk. I have one question and maybe one comment, a kind of question comment. First is, as far as I know, in the Quran it is stated that Muhammad is the last prophet, if I'm not incorrect. So how did the Rumi address that? How did he in Quran, as far as I know, sorry, it is stated that Muhammad is the last prophet. And Rumi, being a Muslim, actually a pretty devout Muslim, as far as I know, how did he reconcile with that, and also with the notion that his matnavi is a complementary or even continuation of the what Muhammad delivered? So how did he reconcile with this? And the other thing is, the second thing I wanted to mention is, again, as far as I know, Rumi, I think, became Rumi after he met Shamsi Tabriz, the great
yes.
friend he met. Before that, he was almost like an ordinary university professor in Konya, Turkey. And then I remember reading somewhere when he met Shamsi Tabriz, he's a wandering dervish, a crazy man. He came home and he told his wife, "Today I met God." If I'm incorrect, please
correct
me. Sorry,
he took his wife?
He told his wife or somebody at home that he met God today. I might be incorrect on the exact term, but he was so overwhelmed by that meeting, and then he became Rumi as we know of today. So that suggests to me that it is actually a combination of the Sufism from Muhammad's time all the way to Rumi's time, 500 years of development in Sufism. But like you said, it is fragmented, it's not organized. In Rumi, it became maybe perfected, very well expressed, and like took a form, took a voice. I'd like to hear your comment about
that
as well.
Yes, as to the second part of your question, of course, that story is totally false, fictitious.
False.
Yes. of course, the meeting with Shamsi Tabrizi is a historical fact, no doubt about it. But the rest, as you mentioned, he said his wife, that he had seen God. No, that's not the case. And now, but of course, as you mentioned, Rumi was a religious scholar. He was like a Ghazali before he met Rumi. You know, he was very well versed in Hadith, in Quran, in religious sciences, in jurisprudence, everything. And he was a mudarris, you know, a teacher, and he had his own madrasa and so on and so forth. But at the age of 38, when he met, you know, Shamsi Tabrizi, or at the age 40, as it is said, because the age 40 is the age of perfection, so, and maturity. So it was nearly, you know, at the same time, at the same age that he met Shamsi Tabrizi, and he was resurrected anew, as he mentioned later on. And he said that there was a qiyamah, a resurrection happened to him, you know, at the moment that he met Shamsi Tabrizi, and so on. So it was, of course, that meeting, which was very, important, and, you know, made him a Sufi. But as far as the first part of your question is concerned, look, according to Rumi and most of Sufis, revelation has not stopped. you know, the Prophet Muhammad was one of the prophets, one of the men of God who received the revelation. The revelation is an ongoing thing in the whole history. There are some prominent, you know, people who tell us that they receive revelation. But revelation is everywhere. It's everywhere for everybody who is a recipient, who is, you know, who is capable of receiving the revelation. Therefore, Rumi is no exception, that he could perhaps receive the revelation. This is absolutely consistent with the teachings of his own school and the school of other Sufis, as far as we know. Revelation has not stopped. Actually, they say that it cannot be stopped, because God is the source of revelation, like sun is the source of light. You know, so the light is always shining everywhere. You have to have a mirror, you know, in order to, you know, put it like this in front of sun, in order to reflect the light of the sun. Some people have got the mirror and some people do not have the mirror. And the symbolism and the imagery of mirror is there in Rumi. Several times he says that we are like mirrors, but we have to polish ourselves. Muhammad was a polished mirror. Rumi was a polished mirror. And all, actually, mysticism is there in order to tell you and to teach you how to polish your mirror. Now we are dark mirrors, and we cannot reflect the light of God. It means that we cannot receive the revelation from God. He cannot, you know, directly speak to us, because our ears does not function well. Again, this is one of the imageries in Rumi, that there are some, cotton, in your ears, you have to take them out, take them away in order to receive the voice of God, and so on. So mysticism is there in order for you to clean your ears, to polish your mirrors, to polish your heart, and so on and so forth. So he actually was quite aware, and he did not, you know, hesitate to tell us that for everybody there is a possibility of receiving the revelation from God. Actually, Rumi thought that following the Prophet did not mean only to follow his orders, but to follow his path. He tells us that for the Prophet there was an experience of Mi'raj, going to heavens. Why don't you go to heavens? He opened the way. Actually, it is not the case that in order to be the follower of the Prophet, you just say, okay, he told us to pray, we pray. He told us to fast, then we fast, and so on. That is not enough. This is not a true followership. In order to be a true follower of the Prophet, you have to manage to go to Mi'raj, to go to heavens. This is the real teaching of the Prophet. So for him, actually, receiving revelation was no contradiction. But, and this is a big but, he says that the Prophet Muhammad was a prophet with a mission. I, Rumi, I am a prophet with no mission.
We have time for one more question. Unfortunately, Professor Sirush has to go to another engagement. Those of you who speak Persian, you are fortunate enough, there's three more of these. Those of you who do not, I suggest you begin learning.
I'm glad to have a chance of asking the last question, Dr. Sirush. The way you introduce the Maulavi, you know, is suggest the backdrop of Persian and Islamic mysticism, by Ibn Arabi, by Yazid al-Bastami, and others. And then, like I said, against this backdrop, you know, Rumi rises and becomes the champion of love-based mysticism and all. But over time, centuries later, his message is widespread all over the world. You know, we are in America in 21st century, and I'm American, which has probably no relationship with that Islamic teaching and understanding relates to Maulavi. And this is actually what you said, that Maulavi is present today and alive. And I'm wondering, how central do you think it is in his teaching, in Islam and mysticism in the way that we learned it? If you take out those pillars from his teaching, Is it the case that the building still stands, you know, replace God with law, and many concepts with similar concepts closer to our today's work? In other words, is that Basto Gabza Teoriti Shariat applies here as well or not?
Well, I mean, it's a long story. Of course, I mean, Rumi should be read in the light of the present day, you know, understanding of, and this is what we do it about the Quran and any sacred book, any scripture, any book which comes to us from the past, especially the books which contain some transcendental messages. Therefore, Rumi is central, no doubt about it. He was central in Islamic civilization, and he is still central. We can learn a lot from him, and we can reinterpret him, no doubt about it. I am sure that some of his messages were not well received in the past, but perhaps nowadays we can understand it, we can compare it, and we can build a new and a modern mysticism on the basis of what Rumi had got to tell us. I am not saying that Rumi is enough. Of course, he was a human being with his own limitations, and his book has got some limitations, some errors, and which is quite natural for a human being. But he is a source of ideas which can be reinterpreted in order, because for us nowadays, and as you say, I have argued in my Qabz and Bast of Sharia, the expansion and contraction of religious knowledge, that all knowledge have to be coordinated, you know, with each other. This the reflective equilibrium, as Rawls says. So our mysticism nowadays must be, to some extent, consistent with our philosophy, with our even science and all this. Therefore, we cannot, you know, import Rumi's mysticism like that. So we have to change it. We have to revisit it. We have to reinterpret it. And that's why, actually, every generation makes its own selection. Every generation makes its own selection. And we need a new selection of Rumi in order to fit our needs and our demands nowadays, and perhaps to put him in his own proper place in the modern age.
This might be close to your heart. How can we go from the politics and economics of fear to one of love?